9. The girl was waiting demurely at the security annex. Kaminsky ordered the taxi to pull up at the darkened runway. He leaped out and strode up the gloomy walk toward the long concrete building. After a short interval, he returned with a small, solemn figure. By now, he had managed to get her name.
"Tyler," he muttered, helping her into the taxi. "This is Doug and Nina Kasich." Indicating the girl, he finished, "Tyler Fleming."
"Hello,"
Tyler said huskily, tossing her head back and smiling shyly around at them. She had large, dark eyes and short-cropped jet-black hair. Her skin was smooth and faintly tanned. She was slender, almost thin, body very young and unformed under her simple evening dress. Nina examined her critically and said,
"I've seen you around. Aren't you a security employee?"
"I'm in research,"
Tyler answered in an almost inaudible whisper.
"I've only been with security a few months." "You'll get along,"
Nina observed, signaling the taxi to rise. In a moment, they were on their way up. Irritably, Nina stabbed down on the high-velocity stud mounted by her armrest.
"It's almost 1 o'clock," she explained. "If we don't hurry, we won't see anything."
"See?" Kasich echoed apprehensively.
At Nina's direction, the taxi let them off in the North Beach section of San Francisco. Kasich satisfied the robot meter with $90 in change, and the taxi shot off. To their right was Columbus Avenue and its notorious rows of bars and dives and cabarets and black market restaurants. People were out roaming the streets in great numbers. The sky overhead was choked with inner-city taxis setting down and taking off. Multicolored signs winked. On every side glared chattering, flickering displays. Seeing where Nina had brought them, Kasich felt a pang of dismay. He knew she had been going to San Francisco. Police reports had mentioned her presence in the North Beach surveillance area. But he had assumed it was clandestine, a covert protest. He hadn't expected her to bring him along. Nina was already heading purposefully toward the descending stairs of a subsurface bar. She seemed to know exactly where she was going. Catching up with her, he demanded,
"You sure you want to do this?"
Nina halted.
"Do what?"
"This is one area I wish they had demolished. Too bad the bombs didn't finish it once and for all."
"We'll be all right," she assured him primly. "I know people here."
"My God," Kaminsky exclaimed, seeing for the first time where they were. "We're close to them."
"To whom?"
Kasich asked, puzzled. Kaminsky's sagging face snapped oblique. He said nothing more. Placing his hand on Tyler's shoulder, he guided her toward the stairs. Nina had already started down. Reluctantly, Kasich followed after her. Kaminsky came last, in a dark world of his own, thinking and muttering about esoteric matters known only in the gnawing doubt of his own consciousness. Tyler, serious and sedate, descended willingly, without resistance. Young as she was, she seemed totally self-possessed. There was no sign of wonder on her face. The underground level was jammed with people, a densely packed mass that stirred and undulated like a single organism. A constant blare of tinny noise roared up deafeningly. The air was translucent with a shimmer of smoke, perspiration, and the steady shouting of human beings. Robot servants, suspended from the ceiling, wheeled here and there, serving drinks and collecting glasses.
"Over here,"
Nina called, leading the way. Kasich and Kaminsky exchanged glances. These places were not strictly illegal, of course, but security would have preferred to close them. The San Francisco North Beach region was the bête noire of the vice squads, a last remnant of the pre-war red light stratum. Nina seated herself at a tiny wooden table crammed against the wall. Overhead, an imitation candle flickered fitfully. Kasich pulled up a packing crate and settled himself uncomfortably. Kaminsky went through the mechanical ritual of finding Tyler a chair and then one for himself. Bending over, he laid his package on the floor, propped against a table leg. The four people sat pressed tightly together, elbows and feet touching, facing one another across the square, waterlogged surface of the table.
"Well," Nina said gaily, "here we are."
Her voice was barely audible above the din. Cusick hunched over and tried to shut out the constant clamor. The close air, the frenetic motion of people made him vaguely ill. Nina's good time had a grim, deliberate quality about it. He wondered what Tyler thought. She didn't seem to think anything. Pretty, competent, she sat unfastening her coat, an agreeable expression on her face.
"This is the price we pay," Kaminsky's voice came in Cusick's ear. "We have relativism. Everybody to his own tastes."
Some of his words reached Nina.
"Oh, yes," she agreed with a tight smile. "You have to let people do as they want."
The robot waiter dropped like a metal spider from the ceiling, and Nina turned her attention to ordering. From the bill of fare, she selected an oral preparation of heroin, then passed the punch sheet to her husband. Petrified, Cusick watched the robot bring forth a cellophane packet of white capsules.
"You're taking those?" he demanded. "Now and then," Nina answered noncommittally, tearing open the packet with her sharp nails.
Numbly, Cusick ordered marijuana for himself. Kaminsky did the same. Tyler examined the bill of fare with interest and finally chose a liqueur built around the drug Artemisia. Cusick paid the bill, and the waiter, after delivering the orders, accepted the money and sailed off. His wife, already under the influence of the heroin, sat glassy-eyed, breathing shallowly, hands clenched together. A faint sheen of perspiration had risen to her throat. Drop by drop, it trickled down to her collarbone and evaporated in the warmth of the room. The drug, he knew, had been severely cut by police order, but it was still a powerful narcotic. He could sense an almost invisible rhythmic motion to her body. She was swaying back and forth to some auditory disturbance unheard by others. Reaching out, he touched her hand. Her flesh was cold, hard, as pale as stone. "Darling," he said gently. With an effort, she was able to focus on him.
"I," she said, a little sadly, "how are you?"
"Do you really hate us this much?" She smiled.
"Not you. Us. All of us."
"Why?"
"Well,"
Nina said in a remote, detached voice, brought down to reality by fantastic concentration of will.
"It just seems so goddamn hopeless. Everything. Like Max says, there's nothing. We're living in deadness."
Kaminsky, pretending not to hear, pretending not to listen, sat frozen, taking in every word, responding with intense pain.
"I mean," Nina said, "there was the war, and now here we are. And Jackie, too. For what? Where can we go? What can we look for? We're not even allowed to have romantic illusions anymore. We can't even tell ourselves lies. If we do," she smiled without rancor, "then they take us to the forced labor camps."
It was Kaminsky who answered.
"We have Jones. The whirlwind sweeping us away. That's the worst thing about our world. It's permitted the beast to come."
Tyler sipped her cocktail and said nothing.
"What now?"
Nina asked.
You can't keep your world going. You realize it's finished. Jones has come. You have to recognize him. He's the future. It's all interwoven, tied up, mixed. You can't have one without the other. Your world has no future of its own.
Jones will kill us all, Kaminsky said.
But at least it'll have meaning. We'll be doing something.
Nina's voice trailed off, moving farther away from them.
It'll be for something. We'll be reaching out like we used to.
Empty idealism, Cusick said unhappily. Nina didn't answer. She had disappeared into an inner world. Her face was blank, devoid of personality. On the raised platform at the rear of the room, a commotion had begun swinging into life. The floor show of the place, the nightly spectacle. Patrons turned their attention to it. The clog of people at the foot of the stairs craned their necks eagerly. Listlessly, Cusick watched, indifferent to what was happening, his hand still resting on his wife's. The floor show involved two figures, a man and a woman. They smiled at the audience and then removed their clothing. Cusick was reminded of the first day he had seen Jones, that day in early spring, when he had tramped across the slushy black ground to visit the carnival. The bright April day he had witnessed the assorted sports and freaks and mutants collected from the war. Recollection welled up inside him, a mixed nostalgia for his own hopeful youth, his vague ambitions and idealism. The two figures on the stage, professionally agile and supple-bodied, had begun making love. The action was carried out as a ritual. It had been done so many times that it was a series of dance motions without passion or intensity. Presently, as a kind of mounting tempo, the sex of the man began to change. After a time, it was the rhythmic motions of two women. Then, toward the conclusion, the figure that had originally presented itself as a woman transformed itself to a man. And the dance ended as it had begun, with a man and a woman quietly making love.
Quite a feat, Kaminsky admitted, as the man and woman put on their clothing, bowed, and left the stage.
They had exchanged clothes. The final effect was overwhelming. A round of sincere applause rippled through the room. The couple were artists.
I remember when I first saw hermaphrodite mutants in action. Now it seems just one more,
Kaminsky searched ironically.
One more example of relativism in action.
For a while, none of the four people spoke. Finally, Tyler said,
I wonder how far we can go.
I think we've gone as far as we can, Cusick answered. All we can hope for now is to hang on.
Did we go too far?
Kaminsky asked appealingly. No, Cusick said flatly. We were right. We're right now. It's a paradox, a contradiction, a criminal offense to say it, but we're right. Secretly, covertly, we gotta believe it. His fingers clutched convulsively around his wife's cold hand. We've gotta try to keep our world from falling completely apart.
Maybe it's too late, Kaminsky said.
Yes, Nina agreed suddenly. It's too late.
Her fingers jerked away from Cusick's. Jaw working spasmodically, she hunched forward, teeth chattering, pupils dilated.
Please, darling.
Cusick rose, and Tyler beside him.
I'll take care of her, Tyler said, moving around the table to Nina. Where's the women's room?
Thanks, Kaminsky said, accepting a cigarette from Cusick.
The women had not returned. As he lit up, Kaminsky remarked,
I suppose you know Jones has written a book.
Different from the Patriots United publications, From the floor by the table, Kaminsky lifted up his brown-wrapped package. He untied it carefully.
This is a summary. The Moral Struggle is called. It outlines his whole program, what he really wants, what he really stands for, the mythos of the movement.
He set the bulky volume down in the center of the table and riffled the pages.
Have you read this? Cusick asked, examining it. Not the whole thing. It isn't complete. Jones is pontificating it orally. The book is transcribed from his harangues. It's growing by leaps and bounds.
What did you mean, Cusick asked, when you said we were near them? Who were you talking about? A strange, oblique, withdrawn look appeared on the older man's face. Gathering up his book, he began to rewrap it.
I don't remember saying that.
As we were coming in. Kaminsky fooled with his package. He laid it back on the floor against the table leg.
One of these days you may be brought into it, but not yet.
Can you give me any information?
No, not really. It's been going on a while. It's important. Obviously, it's here in this area. Obviously, it involves a number of individuals.
Does Jones know?
Kaminsky shuddered. God forbid. Sure, maybe. Doesn't he know everything? Anyhow, he can't do anything about it. He has no legal power.
Then this is under FedGov.
Oh, yes.
Kaminsky agreed bleakly.
FedGov is still in business, trying out a few last tricks before it goes down to ruin.
You don't sound like you think we can beat this thing.
Do I sound like that? All we're up against is a profit. We ought to be able to handle that. There have been prophets before. The New Testament is full of them.
What do you mean by that? There's John the Baptist. You mean him?
I mean him who John foretold.
You're raving.
No, I'm repeating. I hear that kind of stuff. The second coming. After all, he was supposed to show up again sometime. And the world certainly needs him now.
But that puts the drifters in the position of... Cusick grimaced. What's the term?
Hordes from hell.
Blowing clouds of gray cigarette smoke, Kaminsky continued.
Satan's legions, the evil ones.
Then we haven't gone back 100 years, we've gone back 1,000.
Yeah, maybe this won't be so bad. The drifters aren't people, they're mindless blobs. Let's assume the worst. Let's assume Jones gets a war whipped up. We finish the drifters here and then clean the planets one by one. After that,
Kaminsky gestured.
To the stars, with bulging battleships, hunting down the bastards, exterminating the race. Well, what then? The enemy's gone. A race of gigantic amoebae has perished. Is that so bad? I'm only trying to see the possibilities in this. We'll be out beyond the system. And right now, without the spur, the hatred, the sense of fighting an enemy, we just sit around.
You're saying what Jones says, Cusick reflected.
You bet I am.
Want me to show you your error? The danger isn't in the war. It's in the attitude that makes the war possible. To fight, we have to believe we're right and they're wrong, white versus black, good versus evil. The drifters have nothing to do with it. They're only a means.
I disagree with you on one point,
Kaminsky said intently.
You're convinced, are you, that in the war itself there's no danger?
Sure, Cusick said. But he was suddenly uncertain. What can primitive one-celled protoplasm do to us?
I don't know. But we've never fought a war with non-terrestrials. I wouldn't want to take the chance. Remember, we still don't know what they are. We may be surprised one of these days, surprised or even worse, we may find out.
Threading their way among the tightly packed tables, Tyler and Nina returned to their seats. Pale and shaken, but fully in command of herself, Nina sat clasping her hands together, her attention on the raised platform.
"Are they gone?" she asked faintly. "We were wondering," Tyler said, "how those hermaphrodites decide. That is, while Nina and I were in there, one of them might come in too, and we wouldn't know whether to resent it."
Daintily, she sipped at her drink.
"A lot of unusual-looking women came and went, but neither one of the hermaphrodites."
"There's one of them over there," Nina said shakily. "Over by the tune maker."
Leaning against the square metal machine stood one of the dancers, the one that had originated as a young man. It was still a woman as it had ended its act. Slender, with close-cut sandy hair, wearing a skirt and blouse and sandals, it was a perfect androgyny. Its smooth, neutral face was empty of expression. It looked a trifle tired, nothing more.
"Ask her to come over," Nina said, touching her husband's arm.
"There's no room," Cusick said flatly. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. "And don't you go over." He saw her sink back. "You stay here."
Nina flashed him a swift, animal-like glance and then subsided.
"You're still feeling that way, are you?"
"What way?"
"Let it go."
Nina's hands moved restlessly on the surface of the table.
"Could we have something to drink? I'd like cognac."
When their fresh drinks arrived, Nina lifted her glass in a toast.
"Here's two,"
she announced. The other glasses came up. There was a faint clink as they touched.
"To a better world."
"God," Kaminsky said wearily. "I hate talk like that."
Faintly amused, Nina asked,
"Why?"
"Because it doesn't mean anything."
Slumped over, Kaminsky struggled with his whiskey sour.
"Who isn't for a better world?"
"Is it true," Tyler said after a time, "that they've sent out scouts to Proxima Centaurus?"
Kaminsky nodded.
"They have."
"Any luck?"
"The data hasn't been sifted."
"In other words," Tyler said, "nothing of value."
Kaminsky shrugged.
"Who knows?"
"Jones,"
Nina murmured.
"Then ask him, or wait for the official release. Don't bother me about it."
"What's this business with Pearson?" Cusick asked, to change the subject. "I've heard rumors that he's working night and day, lining up men, organizing projects."
"Pearson is determined to stop Jones," Kaminsky answered remotely. "He's sure it can be done."
"But if we get as fanatic as they are..."
"Pearson is worse. He eats, sleeps, thinks, lives Jones. He can't rest. Every time I go into his wing, there's a battalion of weapons cops hanging around, guns and tanks and projectiles."
"You think it'll do any good?"
"Darling,"
Nina said, measuring her words,
"don't you see anything positive in it?"
"Like what?"
"I mean, here we have a man with this wonderful talent. He can do something we've never done. We don't have to guess anymore. We know. We can be sure where we're going."
"I like to guess," Cusick said flatly.
"Do you? Maybe that's where the fault lies. Maybe you don't realize that most people want certainty. You've rejected Jones. Why? Because your system, your government, is built around not knowing, around guesswork. It assumes nobody can know."
She raised her cold blue eyes.
"But now we can know. So, in a way, you're outmoded."
"Well," Tyler said, amused, "then I'm out of a job."
"What did you do before you came to security?" Cusick asked her.
I didn't do anything. This is my first job. I'm only 17. I feel a little out of place with you people. I really don't have any experience.
Indicating the girl's glass, Kaminsky said, I can tell you one thing. That wormwood will rot your nervous system away. It attacks the upper spinal ganglia.
Oh, no, Tyler said quickly. I'm doped against it.
She touched her purse.
For this, I have to depend on a synthetic neutralizer, or I wouldn't want to take it.
Cusick's respect for her rose another notch.
What part of the world do you come from? He asked curiously. I was born in China. My father was a policy-level official in the Kuai Ping Secretariat of the Chinese People's Communist Party.
Then you were born on that side of the war, Cusick said, amazed. You grew up on, he grimaced, what people used to call the Jewish atheist communist side.
My father was a devout party worker. He fought with all his soul and heart against the Mohammedans and the Christian fanatics. He brought me up. My mother was killed by bacterial toxins. Since she wasn't an official, she wasn't entitled to shelter. I lived with my father in the party offices a mile or so underground. We were there until the war ended.
She corrected herself.
That is, I was there. My father was shot by the party near the end of the war.
Shot for what?
Deviationism. The Hof book was being circulated in our area, too. My father and I set up portions by hand. We circulated them among party workers. It was quite revolutionary. Many of us had never heard of the multiple value system, the idea that everybody might be right, that everybody was entitled to his own way of life, had a startling effect on us. The Hof concept of personal style of living, it was exciting. Neither religious dogma nor anti-religious dogma, no more wrangling over which interpretation of the sacred texts was correct, no more sects, splinter groups, factions, no more heretics to shoot and burn and lock up.
You're not Chinese, Nina said.
No, I'm English. My family were Anglican missionaries before they became communists. There was a community of English communists living in China.
Do you remember much about the war? Kaminsky asked her.
Not much. The Christian raiding parties from Formosa, mostly just the printing at night, the secret distribution.
How did you get off? Cusick asked. Why didn't they shoot you too?
I was 8 years old, too young to shoot. One of the party chiefs adopted me. A very kind old Chinese gentleman who still read Lao Tzu and had gold carvings cut into his teeth. I was a ward of the CP when the war ended and the party apparatus disintegrated.
She shook her head.
It was all such a terrible waste. The war could so easily have been avoided if people had only been just a little less fanatic.
Nina had gotten to her feet.
Darling, she said to her husband. Please, could you do me a favor? I'd like to dance.
One section of the crowded floor had been cleared for dancing. A few couples pushed mechanically back and forth. You really feel like it? Cusick asked warily as he got to his feet. Maybe for a minute.
She's a lovely girl, Nina said distantly as the two of them found their way out onto the packed floor.
It's interesting, her circulating Hof's material among party officials. Suddenly Nina clutched her husband tight.
I wish, her voice broke achingly. Isn't there some way we can go back?
Back? He was perplexed.
Back where? The way we were, not quarreling all the time. We seem to be so far apart. We don't understand each other anymore.
He held his wife close to him. Under his hands, her body was surprisingly fragile. It's this damn thing. Someday it'll be over and we'll be together like we used to. Stricken, Nina gazed up imploringly.
Does it have to be over? Does it have to be gotten rid of? Can't we accept it?
No, Cossack said. I'll never accept it. The woman's sharp nails dug futilely into his back. For an interval she rested her head against his shoulder, tumble of blonde hair billowing into his face. The familiar scent of her tickled his nose, the sweet perfume of her body, the warmth of her hair. All this, the smoothness of her bare shoulders, the silky texture of her dress, the faint sheen of perspiration glowing on her upper lip. Harshly, he held her against him, squeezing her silently, yearningly. Presently she uptilted her chin, smiled waveringly, and kissed him on the mouth.
"We'll try," she said softly. "We'll do our best, right?"
"Sure," he answered, meaning it with all his heart. "It's too important. We can't let our lives slip away like this. And now that we have Jack." Roughly, his fingers crumpled into the base of her neck, lifting her torrent of thick hair. "We don't want to leave him for the vultures,"